gasoline machines if they want to sit.
Right. So well, it'll take a little while. But, you know, you might as well just grab, I put enough seats down here that it should hold everybody. There's all kinds of architectural detail in here that you can look at. This whole 27,000 square foot addition was done in 92. And it was done in 10 and a half months. So, and there are still craftsmen that do this kind of stuff. It's decorators supplying all of the casts for all of the plasterwork. The tin ceiling is real tin from a company that has been making it for 100 plus years. The seal beams up there are done by Waller. Seal and it's not just decorative, it's structural. And what it does is it holds up the balcony or the attic, and then above the attic up there is steel trussing that holds the roof up. But the whole building, if you happen to be downstairs after that, you can see photo albums on the coffee table in the basement that show the construction and how all this is held together. So, let's see, why am I sharing? I need to have him turn off that banjo.
Why don't you go find Jerry and I'll introduce you.
All right. Well, no, you can be wrong.
I hope he talks from up there because that's where I have the microphone.
I guess we don't need to introduce Robert. You guys have already met him over the last couple of days. But I really want to thank him as he is exiting the room for making all of this possible. I first asked Robert, I guess a year and a half ago, about the possibility of doing something out here. And he had never heard of ours. He didn't know what I was talking about. And I said, well, let me send you some information. So I dropped it in the mail, and he got it, and he emailed me immediately. He said, I cannot believe that I have been around doing this kind of work since the year your organization was founded, and I've never heard of you. Robert is a longtime member of the Audio Engineering Society and other professional organizations. And he's been involved with sound transfer and audio tape, and all the sort of issues that we as archivists and collectors deal with as well. So he immediately wanted a complete set of all available back issues of the Ars Journal, and is as gung-ho about this organization as any of the rest of us. And he is particularly delighted to be able to share this collection with us today. I don't think I need to tell you that this is a very, very special day, not only for us, but for the San Filippo staff and family as well. I don't know if other organizations have the opportunity to spend an entire day at this facility to view at our leisure the collections and to have our meals and a live organ concert. Most events here are charitable organizations who are doing fundraisers, and they're here for a couple of hours and maybe a meal. So you are extremely privileged to be here, and I know that you'll want to take an opportunity to thank Robert, Jasper, and their staff for making this possible. Robert is about to give us a program on the history and types of automatic musical instruments, and he will be doing so with Rob Bland. Rob emailed this for me to read to introduce him. He's been a record and piano roll collector since the fourth grade. His primary musical interests are jazz, blues, classical, and opera. He began reissuing ragtime and blues player piano rolls in 1988 under the Blues Tone Music Rolls name, featuring roles by artists such as Scott Joplin, Charlie Strait, James P. Johnson, Jelly Roll Morton, Cal Davenport, Seeger Ellis, Jimmy Blythe, John Arvin, and many others. He has since branched out to include Nickelodeon roles, and most recently, new art and wealthy reproducing piano roles. He compiled the rollography of the earliest QRS hand-play roles, which was published in the Amica Bulletin. Amica is the Association of... the Automatic Musical Instrument Collectors Association Bulletin, right? They are primarily involved with pneumatically powered machines like player pianos as opposed to the Music Box Society or MBSI, which covers things that are not exclusively pneumatic. Besides preservation, his favorite sound recording interests involve firsts. The first cylinder records, first disc records, electrical recordings, LPs, stereo, etc. He graduated from the University of Illinois with a BSEE in 1981 and has worked as a test engineer at Motorola for most of the time since then. He is currently working on an MS in library science for U of I with a particular interest in archival work and digital projects. He is currently looking for intern or practicum opportunities in the Chicago or Milwaukee area, preferably in an audio archive. I told him that this was the place to find such a position. So I'm sure one of you at least will come up and have a job offer before the end of this day. By the way, Rob also mentioned that he's interested in starting a Chicago area arts chapter. So if anyone lives in the Chicago area and would like to be a part of that, be sure to touch base with him. And now I want to introduce Rob and Robert, and look forward to hearing what they have to say.
Give me my headphones.
We'll see how that works. I'll try to keep it pointed up for one. Yeah. Thank you all. As we're trying to get ready for this, Robert's going to do most of the talking about the organ tonight, so he offered me the opportunity to do this part. There's so many things we could spend the afternoon doing here. There's the American machines off to that side. This room is mostly full of European machines, the theater organ, all the steam stuff, the phonograph things. And, of course, we've all seen all the stuff out of the carousel building, so it's a little daunting. What I decided I'd try to do was kind of split my talk into three things. I wanted to talk a little bit about a history of the music roll, because I think that will tie into a lot of the things we've heard talk about today as well as the last couple of days. And then next, I want to highlight some of the more significant musical aspects, in my opinion, about automatic music. And then, most importantly, to get around to talking about this collection and to highlight some of the more interesting machines in this room. Try to imagine if you were working for a foundry and you just installed a dozen bells in the year 1400 and you're supposed to automate this and they want you to provide the digital data that's going to run this machine, what would you do? Well, you'd come up with some kind of a pin cylinder. And there's examples in some of the books here of such sort of the pictures of pin cylinder operated bell ringing devices from back to 1500. There's descriptions of that sort of a mechanism back to like 30 BC. And of course, as we've kind of figured out this morning, or this afternoon here, a pin cylinder was the primary way to automate music instruments up till about the 1880s or 1890s. So I think that's interesting to think about, especially when we talk about the phonograph was relatively unchanged from 1877 till 1980-something when the CD came around. Well, pin cylinders were unchanged for about 2,000 years. And that was really the only way you could have automated your machine. Originally, a pin cylinder, I need to cut some of this out since we've already heard it, would have been fixed like a small a snuff box, that sort of a thing, small music box. Later they had interchangeable cylinders and then barrels. We've seen the barrel playing Imhoff in over here. I've got a monkey organ here. This is about 1895. Obviously, the peak of that technology would have been the large pin barrel machines like the Imhoff at the top of the stairs. I hope everybody had a chance to peek behind and see the 35 pin barrels behind it in the room back there. Like we heard this early this afternoon, machines like the Welty, that's a Welty Style 2 over there, would have originally been a pinned cylinder machine, and the sound of the machine is still fairly similar after it's roll driven. It's still that delicate kind of a machine sound that you get. The technology is clearly is pins actuating levers or musical teeth on a comb to make the noise. And The only other alternatives, I would say, to a pin cylinder, there were ways to do with metal discs. But again, the metal disc would have been a mechanical thing that, triggered an event, you know, and ultimately made music. For paper rolls, the earliest examples, again, this was mentioned in the previous talk, the rolls were still not, well, they were triggering something. In this case, as the hole opened up on the tracker bar, air would go through a reed and allow the reed to speak. There was no mechanism that was reading the tracker bar. There was simply a hole opened and then air flowed through to make the note speak. Not yet. After that, the later technology would be for the holes in the tracker bar to actuate a mechanism. There'd be some kind of device that would detect that the hole was open, and it would allow something else to happen, a piano note to play, an automatic register to turn on and off, and that sort of a thing, which is basically the foundation for a lot of the rest of the machines later. The problems with early paper rolls were that the paper was not stable. They would not hold their dimensions in humidity, and they wouldn't track properly, so they'd slide off of the holes they were supposed to be aligned with, and they wouldn't play properly. I have a couple examples here. I don't know how I'm going to do this with two hands, but here's a few early Welty Mignon, the piano rolls. And I love the announcement on this thing. It says, there's a paper label in here. It says, music rolls must always be kept in boxes and placed in cabinet containing a basin of water during the winter to prevent contraction and expansion. Not responsible for correct playing unless conditions above stated adhered to. So if it didn't play, they didn't want to hear about it. Similarly, I have an example of a roll where the center of the roll was 6 holes to the inch across. And as you went towards the edge of the roll, they backed off to 4 holes per inch, so they'd have more spacing, because, of course, the edge of the roll would be open, expanding and contracting more, and that would give them a little more flexibility for tracking under poor conditions. And then I have an article, a little blurb here from the Music Trade Review from September 1905. There was a company, the Conorized Music Roll Company, was bragging about their paper. James O'Connor, president of the Auto Music Perforating Company in this city, New York, was able to give the representative of the Music Trade Review an objective lesson this week in the superiority of Conorized paper when used in music rolls over the ordinary paper employed with some players. He showed us 2 perforated music rolls which he had received from a dealer. One of these, which had the Conorized mark on it, was properly rolled and did not appear to have been subjected to any unusual humid conditions. The other was badly creased and overlapped the flange, the edge there, so that it was evident that it could not be made to track. Accompanying these rolls was a letter from the dealer who had forwarded them, in which occurred the following significant paragraph. I am sending you by express today 2 rolls, one of which you shipped me in May, and the other which came from blank, and which I got at the same time. We have had a lot of rainy weather hereabouts the past few months, and in looking over my stocks of rolls, I found that those made by you that had the Conorized mark on them did not expand at all and played perfectly, while the greater part of the rolls I had gotten from the others were in about the same shape as the one I'm sending you. I feel I must congratulate you on this, as your patent paper beats everything else on the market. So, and I have a Conorized roll here. I can show you their little bragging point. It says, Conorized trademark, this roll will play and rewind irrespective of atmospheric conditions. So they were very proud of their paper. Rolls kind of settled in on about 6 holes to the inch, and that's going from left to right across a tracker bar. That was about as dense as they could make the channels in the paper roll where they could count on it being reliable to play. The earliest ones, a 6 to the inch, there's a 58-note roll. What I held up was a 65-note roll, and they had another one that was an 88-note roll. It was about 15 inches wide, but they managed to play all 88 notes. And one of the early companies was the Melville Clark Piano Company. Melville Clark was a very interesting guy. He was the Clark of Story and Clark, if you've heard of the pianos and organs. That was founded in 1895. The Melville Clark Piano Company was incorporated in 1900. They offered the first 88-note player piano in 1902. It was still this sixth of the inch thing. And the QRS company grew out of Melville Clark Company. It was just part of the company as they were making rolls. They eventually called it QRS. And that obviously spun off and was the company that stayed in business the longest. Interestingly, I have another article in here somewhere. Around 1902, there was a lawsuit about copyrights. You know, the publishing companies were suing the roll companies for infringing their patents or their copyrights, and they were arguing whether a piano roll was a copyrighted thing or not. And even at that date, 1902, I think it was, they stated they didn't know what QRS meant. So it's interesting in the catalog, as they claim it means quality roll service or quality reel service or something like that. And even as far back as 1902, there was documented that they didn't know what that meant. The same time that was happening on the player roll market, Nickelodeons, the coin pianos, like especially the American machines we saw, were being developed. A 10-tune roll like the L piano that I'll play here in a few minutes. That's a standard width, a roll, the same as the 65-note roll. A 65-note player piano roll has pinned ends. If you ever see these, those are the second most common rolls that you'll find in an antique shop or something. They had the pins on both ends. And those are sixth of the inch across and play 65 notes of the piano. That same scale is used on A rolls, which is the most common Nickelodeon roll, which again I'll talk about A rolls in a bit. And then Seberg came out with an H roll, which I'm going to try to hold up here. This was, can you? The H roll was 15 inches wide. It was still sixth of the inch roll, but it allowed, obviously, that many more channels to work with, and the Seberg H and J and a couple other pianos. This is an original roll, but it's a replacement leader on it, so you can see where they spliced the leader on and did some mending on the roll. But that's, again, six holes per inch as you go across the tracker bar, 15 inches wide. There's a Seberg H in the room at the far end on the right side. It's the one with the two statues on either side of the main part of the piano. So that was... That's pretty much how the paper rolls were incorporated in American machines. Once they got to that point, I'd like to say that paper rolls were finally stable and reliable enough that they could do what they wanted with them. And I'd like to compare that to data and disk memory today, where now you've got stability. Maybe that's like the early hard drives. You've got a 20 meg hard drive, and the rest is history. You work your way up. Paper rolls, that was the first stable point we reached. They later came up with a 9 to the inch, and that's what a standard player piano roll is, 9 tracks across. And that's how you can get an 88-note roll without going to this long 15-inch. You can stick with the 11 and a quarter inch and get all 88 notes on a player piano roll. They used that same scale on Nickelodeon rolls as well. I've got a M roll. I was playing a Cremona piano for somebody a little while ago. It has, again, this is an original roll that, But I don't know if you kind of tell maybe that the holes are smaller, and that's the same spacing as same width of paper and same hole spacing as a standard player piano roll. But on the Nickelodeon, they didn't use all 88 notes. They used some of the channels to control when they turned different pipes on and off and had different traps and things going on like that. The last development after they went, again, sixth of the inch was the early style and most common Nickelodeon style. 9 to the inch was the most common player piano roll and used in some Nickelodeons. And they actually got all the way up to 12 holes per inch. I have a couple examples of those. The small one is from they actually made a player Hammond organ for about a week, I think. And this, I believe, is a test roll. So they're not unheard of. I've seen several of them, but the music is pretty scary. So... And maybe you can see it easier on this. This is an Aeolian duo art organ roll. This was, again, you see you're back to the 15-inch wide, but they have 12 to the inch. So how many, 140?
176.
Channels. This is a recut. There's a fellow named Carl Lambie who made a machine to cut this roll. He gave it to me because he had to splice the original paper halfway through the roll, and so he couldn't sell it. But... maybe you can see how fine these holes are, and you're welcome to inspect it later on, but they're tiny. And they use all of that to control in different ranks of the pipe organ independently. It's an incredible thing. Now,
I'll leave this one unrolled over here. So
to deal with dimensional problems, they actually had the tracker bar split into five sections, and the tracker bar would actually expand and contract to track the paper, of all things. So that was kind of interesting. An interesting point, when I started issuing rolls in 88, the people that cut my rolls for me told me that they ordered their paper from Parchment, Michigan, a paper company there, who said that they needed to wait until an industry, I forget how they worded it, but there was an industrial client who ordered this paper, and they waited until that client needed, and then we could make some more for use for paper rolls. So she finally asked him, well, who else uses this paper that we've found that works best today? And he said, it's used for the paper for the top of a pat of butter. It's a waxed paper that holds its dimensions over different humidity. So it's the wax content that makes the paper stronger today that we use.
You can tell we've rehearsed this.
Yeah. Well, originally, roll arrangements would have been done mechanically on a drafting board following the sheet music. In 1905, the Welty Mignon piano that played these red paper rolls, and these are kind of fragile. You can see why you needed to keep your basin of water in the roll cabinet. The Welty came up with a means to record live piano performance, and soon after that, Ampico and DuoArt both had their own recording methods. The Hupfeld and several others in Europe had roll recording capability. QRS made their own roll recorder in 1912. You can still see that in Buffalo. It's a real interesting machine. That was still Melville Clark Piano Company at that point. And I have a couple of pictures here. There's a fellow who lives in Maine now, Don Rand, who rescued, I know you can't see it, but I invite you to come up later. Then the lower left here is a machine that was hooked up to an organ console, and it was designed to actually perforate the roll in real time as somebody played the organ. So that was kind of interesting. QRS introduced the word roll in 1916. That was the beginning of having the words printed on the roll. And there's a lot of other style of rolls that I didn't mention already that don't fit in all the standard stuff I'm talking about here. Wurlitzer, Link, Hupfeld, Weber, most of the machines in this room have their own style of rolls that are different from everything else I've had. Another interesting point before I get off of the paper roll subject, I think, is that nobody was reissuing rolls. The whole automatic music industry kind of fell into a slump. One of the books shows a chart of the manufacturing of player pianos peaked about 1926 and just dropped like a rock. And between the phonograph and the radio, the player piano market was already dead before the Depression hit. Some of them tried to hang on for a few years. Ampico and Dore did what they could to stay on, but the industry was already pretty dead at that point. I met with a collector in the Atlanta area named John Bagley, who had been collecting rolls for years and years. He had over 100 original A rolls that I wanted to go through. And he was telling me stories about in the 50s when the interest was just starting to come back alive on this stuff. He said, you couldn't find original rolls. You could find pianos, like these cabinet pianos were the most popular ones Seberg made. They weren't hard to find. He said there were times when he would trade a piano like that for three rolls, and that would, he thought he was coming out ahead because he couldn't get the darn rolls, but he could get the pianos. And that'll kind of lead me into my music topic, because when I went through John's collection, he had a capital A roll with some great blues music on it. And I'd been working on a catalog of everything that Capitol had put out, because they put out some really interesting blues that I'll talk about more in a minute. And I found this Capitol A roll, and I told him, John, this is the only known copy of this so far. I've been researching all the titles for every Capitol roll I can account for, and I haven't accounted for this title. The first title was Fummy Diddle Blues, and it's not in the catalog under any other roll either. So I said, keep track of this roll, whatever you do. Well, the next thing I know, another friend of mine borrowed it from him and recut it, so we have a copy of it over here now. So that's that kind of collector story that I like to tell. I want to talk about the machines a little bit, kind of bring you up to speed on how the machines evolved, and again, in a very general term like that. Player machines use a pneumatic and a valve are the basic kind of a component. There's a valve that can read the tracker bar and a pneumatic that'll close and push a rod that'll make the note strike on the piano. I'd like to compare that to maybe transistors leading to op-amps, leading to logic gates, NAND or, and then you can just build any kind of logic you want based on those basic components. And if you were to tear apart these different machines around here, you'd find that there's big complex mechanisms to turn ranks of pipes on and to adjust various things inside the piano, but when you get down to it, it's all a matter of pneumatics and valves. So once that was perfected, where they could read a piano roll and turn on a rank of pipes instead of pulling air past a reed, then they were able to do pretty much all the rest of the stuff that these machines do. In there's a book that we've got over at the desk there, the Golden Age of Automatic Music. Art Reblitz wrote this incredible book with pictures of this collection and two others in the area that, between the three of them, they've pretty much got one of everything and a lot of representative stuff. And in there, he calls this the Golden Age, and he says there are two factors that determine the Golden Age. One was the development of the paper roll, where now you can duplicate music cheaply, you can store it without needing a room like we have behind the Imhoff to store 35 rolls. You can store it cheaply and manufacture cheaply. The other factor, Art points out, is the electric motor. Now, we had great demonstrations this morning of the Welty machines where you'd have to turn a crank and wind up 1,000-pound weight up to the top of the machine. This machine is the earliest of the three Welty organs in this collection, and it originally was designed to work that way. After the weight dropped, it was the longest roll that it would play would last for that weight to drop the length of the case. When the roll was done, it stopped. You have to flip a lever, pull out another crank, and rewind the roll by hand. And there wasn't enough length on the weight for it to do it automatically. The next, the Style 4 out here is the next development. That machine would play through and stop. You could flip a lever and then turn it back on and it would rewind. And then the Style 4, is that right? No, this one's the 4, I'm sorry. The 3 in the living room farthest away from here is the most modern of the 3. And on that one, it would play to the end and it would actually kick into rewind automatically and come back to the beginning. But it's interesting on the Welty machines to see that variety of mechanism. At this point, again, I feel the paper roll was established. The mechanisms, the roots of all the mechanisms were there. Now it was just up to the different manufacturers to come up with a machine that had better instrumentation and sounded better than their competitors, and that's how what you see in this room, I think, that's how that evolved. And then try to avoid infringing each other's copyrights or patents, I suppose. Another point I think that helps put this in perspective, automatic music, typically you'll have a pump and a reservoir to keep that pumping level steady. On a player piano, you, of course, pump it with your feet. If the reservoir is too big, the vacuum level is steady all the time, then it's always the same level of volume from the note that you play. And if it's too small, then as you pump it, as you push down, then those notes are louder, and as you're not pushing down, they're softer. So you want a reservoir that's somewhat in the middle. And on a good foot pump or player piano, you can add expression to an 88-note roll by stabbing at the rolls with your feet when you want to accent a certain note. And then when you go to a reproducing piano like the Duart here or the Ampico over here, they had mechanisms built into the piano to do that for you. And the fortunate thing with pneumatic instruments is the pneumatic is very linear. It's easy to control how quickly it'll collapse by the amount of pressure. If you have a lot of vacuum, it'll suck it closed quickly. If you have very little vacuum, you'll suck it closed more slowly, and you can control that by throttling how much of that vacuum goes to the pneumatic. And that's what the reproducing pianos do. They typically split the pneumatic stack in half, so you have the bass half and the treble half, and they'll have a mechanism that operates each of those halves and throttles back on the amount of vacuum that hits the notes. And that's basically how a reproducing piano works. Lost my place here. The larger machines then would add a wind chest to blow air through the pipes, and then, of course, your machine was more expensive. If you think about it, if you build a cabinet piano like that with a xylophone, you don't need a pressure source like you do on pipes. So as pianos were expensive and they needed to bring their costs down, and Seabird wanted to sell more pianos and people weren't buying them, he could remove the pipes and just use a xylophone. It would still interest people, but it cut down on the mechanism quite a bit. We've already heard the Welty was the first of the roll-operated orchestrions. I wanted to tell a couple stories that I think tie in with earlier about the Welties. We mentioned Adelina Patti having a Style 10 in her house. And I have, a lot of you probably know who Fred Gaisberg was. He worked for Emil Berliner. And in his autobiography, he mentions going, when he was at Patti's castle to record her, he mentions seeing the Welty there. He says, I can vouch that we were treated royally. This is, what, 1905 or so that he recorded her? They set before us not only the reserve of their gardens and hothouse, but also the choice of the wine cellars. A master hand knew the vintages which Niccoli had so intelligently laid down, and we drank many toasts to the health of the house. Occasionally, Patti would look in on us and would make some passing joke. She was always ready to share a laugh. One of her treasures was an orchestrion of the type which was in vogue in the big house, country houses of those days. Hers was supposed to be the biggest in England. It, with one blast, it would resound throughout those old walls in a most odd way. At least 60 instruments were represented, and she had 120 music rolls for it. The instrument itself was a Freiburg. That's the city where they were made, so he would have read Freiburg on the case. But he's talking about the Welty. It cost £2,500, and the rolls cost £11 each. That's all he says. There's an LP jacket. A lot of you have probably seen this record. This was a Welty Brisgovia. That was a later model of basically the same kind of machine that was exhibited at the Smithsonian. And then they mention a quote from Patti. I don't know where this quote comes from, but she says, her favorite furnishing was a Welty orchestra, and she wrote, I have much pleasure in saying how greatly I appreciated the marvelous orchestrion you have for me, which has been the admiration of all the royal personages and celebrities who have listened to this perfection of mechanism and melody under my roof. I thought that was kind of neat. I don't know of any other references to her. Jerry was telling me that one of the collectors went over to the town where she lived and to try to determine what happened to her machine, they went to the local piano tuner, who, of course, knew about the machine, and they said it was, what, donated to a church and got water damage and eventually was torn up and discarded, unfortunately. So that's pretty much what I wanted to describe about the machines. On music, I'm going to, again, shift gears on you. There's a lot of interesting stuff on rolls that I think should be mentioned. One is about James P. Johnson. I had a quote. This is a roll of Carolina Shout that he did. And in Duke Ellington's autobiography, Music is My Mistress, he talks about learning to play Carolina Shout from playing this piano roll. He says, my first encounter with James was through the piano roll, the QRS roll. Percy Johnson, the drummer in Washington who told me about them, took me to home with him and played me Carolina Shout. He said I ought to learn it, so how I was going to do it, I wanted to know. He showed me the way. He slowed the machine down, and then I could follow the keys going down. I learned it. And how I learned it. I nursed it, rehearsed it. Yes, this was the most solid foundation for me. I got hold of some of his other roles, and they all helped with styling, but Carolina Shout was my party piece. Then when James came to Washington to play at Convention Hall, it holds maybe 4,000 or 5,000 people. I was always a terrific listener. I'm taller on one side than the other from leaning over the piano. This time I listened all night long. After a while, my local following started agitating. You got to go up there and play that piano piece, they said. Go on, get up there and cut him. So, you know, I had to get up there and play it. You play that good, James said. We were friends then, and I wanted the privilege of showing him around town, showing him the hot spots, introducing him to my pals, the best bootleggers, and so on. That naturally meant more leaning on the piano. Afterwards, we were fast friends, and James never forgot. So, the Jelly Roll Morton rolls are very interesting, too. He recorded for Vocal Style, and there are about a dozen rolls that he issued. I brought one here. I wanted to, if anyone wants to take a look at this later on. When we reissued them, we, contrary to the earlier lecture here, we tried to clean up some of the mistakes. There's chords that clearly have wrong notes in them, and we changed those. We had a theory that the instrumental rolls didn't sell very well. That's why they're hard to find now. And they Vocal Style didn't put much effort into correcting the mistakes in them, whereas the word rolls have very few mistakes, and the original rolls play as without any errors that you would expect. And what's interesting on the Vocal Style rolls is that Morton is able to play out some additional choruses on the piano roll that he never did on the phonograph record, and Jim DePogne at University of Michigan transcribed all those solos that appear on the Jelly Roll Morton piano rolls and published them in his book of the complete Jelly Roll Morton solos. So that's another claim to fame for piano rolls. Jimmy Blythe is another important pianist who made roles. He was a black pianist in the south side of Chicago. And we have some player piano rolls, but his best stuff is on capital A rolls. And that's what I'm going to play here next. This is the cream of the crop. There's a quote in one of these Yazoo CD booklets. He talks about the stuff that dreams are made of. And that's what the capital blues rolls are. That's the ultimate thing to find for collectors. So I'm going to play you a tune called Underworld Blues from Jimmy Blythe A roll. Some of it was also the show on player piano rolls, but most of it not. I'm going to switch to, on the classical side, we've got a duo art roll of the Carmen variations that Horowitz recorded. I'm going to start with the orthophonic, play the 78 there, and then we'll play the duo art roll, and then want to use it as an excuse to demonstrate the auxetophone. I'll let Robert explain how the auxetophone works when we get to that. Thank you. So right about the same time, I think the same year, I'm not sure the same month, they issued the Duart roll, the same thing. So here's Duart, Horowitz on the Duart. The same record, I don't know if you need all of it or not, on the auxetophone. I'll let Robert explain that.
Well, I'm not going to play all of it, but it's a perfect excuse to demonstrate one of the unique engineering marvels. This particular, the phonograph collectors in the group will probably already know what this is. But if you were to go back to 1906 and be tasked with the problem of playing a 78 RPM record in a giant auditorium and having it heard, how would you solve the problem? And most people say, well, build a big horn. Well, that does help a little bit, but this was many years before DeForest, and the solution was by an Englishman who invented a pneumatic amplifier. And the way this works, there is a high-pressure air pump in the bottom, and it goes into a receiver and into another tank up above here, and it comes into the arm through a separate side to it. Now, instead of having a standard reproducer that you'd see in a normal arm, what you have is a very small plate with tiny slots. There is a mating plate that the needle is fastened to, and so when the needle is modulated by the groove, this high-pressure air, which has been trying desperately to escape, pressing against this plate, comes out as a larger analog of the groove, and it comes out through the horn. It's a tremendously ingenious system, and they work wonderfully, except for one small problem. They used a vaned pump that required constant lubrication, and most of the people that bought them failed to take note of that. The pump would seize, and soon the thing would be consumed by fire. This is, of the 500, give or take, that they made of these, there's only, I think, somewhere between 12 and 18 of them left. This is the only totally original one remaining. This was out of the Dr. Drake collection. This is the only original pump. Paul Baker's made a number of these, but he copied this pump in order to do it. So anyway, having said that, I'm going to put this mechanism back together, hopefully, and we'll see if we can get this to work. But this is always a great excuse to show this machine off, because most people never get a chance to see them. Okay. Now, I'm going to close the door so you don't hear the pump. Well, you can see there's the air pump. Okay, now, the minute that I open the valve, when you start to set the arm down, it releases the air. So now, we want to do some instruments. I will hand the microphone back to you, and I will play the 1894 Welty II.
I'm just going to bounce around the room, hit some of the highlights. This is the, like I said, it's the earlier machine. If you notice on the snare drum, there's a little cord that wraps around a device, so you had a separate weight that you had to crank up to drive the snare drum previous to the restoration.
Thank you. play everything all the way through, it'll take weeks. So that's sort of
we're going to jump over the third machine here and the next one. The two on either side of the window are Wurlitzer piano orchestras. These are actually, most of them were made by Philips in Germany and imported by Wurlitzer. I'm not going to play those two. There's the two machines further down where Robert's walking to is a Philips model that never was imported by Wurlitzer, but it's generally known as a piano orchestra or the pianola or piano, let's see. What is the number that they used? Anyway, it plays the same type of role, and it's the larger of the three, so we figured we'd use that one to show it off. Draw your attention to the other side of the room here. This first machine next to the violino is a Pierre Eich. This has nice violin pipes, you'll hear. It's got an unusual pump leading to lower bass pipes on the left side.
This has little tiny string pipes, very delicate wooden string pipes. Thank you.
The other side of the room, Marty's going to turn on the Hupfeld Helios. Hupfeld was one of the bigger German companies. That was the huge one, right, Robert? Hupfeld? They had thousands of employees when Wurlitzer had a few hundred. And this is a Hupfeld Helios Model 1C31. It has a dual tracker bar. Once it's turned on, it's not intended to turn off until the end of the night. So we'll see if it switches roles from it. Marty, can we do the Otero next, please? The next one I'm going to do is this one with another moving scene on it. It's a Weber Otero. Weber made several models that had very interesting violin pipes. If you listen to the violin sound they get from wooden pipes, it's very impressive. They used swell shutters on the top to help improve that. On the moving scene, you'll see a Zeppelin and a hot air balloon go by and a train going across. I forget what train station. There's a specific town that they think that's modeled after. It's a real neat role. This roll has two tunes on it. The first one's a flute solo, and the second one's a violin solo.
Thank you.
Maybe that's a semi-automatic shutoff.
Shut me off.
Thank you.
not nearly as scintillating. Several of you probably heard the three violin machine out in the foyer. The competitor to that was the Mills Novelty Company in Chicago. Mills, ironically, got his start selling peanuts. Isn't that ironic? Believe it or not, Herbert Mills made his original fortune selling peanuts at the 1893 Columbia Exposition. And then he went into the machine business making slot machines and eventually did the violin machine. Now, this was made here in Chicago. It plays all four strings on the violin using little rosined wheels, little discs that turn, and then those discs are pressed against the strings as those strings are called for. And instead of having a fretboard, it has hardened steel fingers that reach out with a V, and it V's the string, and it stops it at that point. And everything in a Mills is DC solenoid. There's no pneumatics whatsoever. Now, for many years, we had heard a lot of these Mills, only some of the early ones were actually hand-played. Later, it was all done tabletop arrangements, and I'm sure that many of these arrangers were paid, you know, by the yard, and the arrangements sound like it. And we thought that some of these machines, good heavens, these are really not very exciting. So what we did, this particular machine, finally an engineer friend of ours found a way to MIDI the system, because you're dealing with heavy current with the DC solenoids, and it took him years to come up with a way to make it work. And he figured he'd only make and sell a half a dozen of these systems, and he sold over 100 so far. So if any of you have a Mills and you want to go and add MIDI to it, it's $6,000, but it opens you up to thousands of rolls, so it's a fabulous way to go. But anyway, what I'm going to do is play you on there the original version of this Fritz Kreisler piece, and you'll notice how exciting the arrangement is. And then you will hear what happens when we had a friend of ours who is a real musician. Fancy that idea. And he rearranged it, and it really now, you realize that the machine is quite capable of beautiful music. Now that's the first machine I'm going to demonstrate. The next one is in the back of the room, but you'll have no trouble hearing it. Toward the latter part of the 20s, or mid-20s, I guess, Seberg was already making huge inroads into digging into Mills' market by virtue of having machines like this that had xylophones and drums and things in it, and all they had to offer was a 44-note piano and a violin, or two violins. And so in a moment of what must have been a peyote-induced stupor, they offered what they called an orchestra cabinet that had a bass drum and a snare drum and a woodblock, etc. Naturally, the things that you would expect to go with a violin and a piano. And I always tell people it sounds like the Guarneri String Quartet meets the Salvation Army Band. And in a radio interview several years ago that Michael Barone did, I don't know why, but I just thought of this as I said it. He said, well, how did these operate? I said, well, there was a nickel slot, and you put the nickel in, and it would play. And I said, come to think of it, if they had put a dollar slot on the opposite side to make it quit at will, they would have made 1,000 times more money. So I will play just a little bit of it after I play this one. It really is that is where I suspect the words Mills novelty truly came into being. So I'll play the first one and then the second one. Thank you.
now, the one with the drum cabinet.
Moaning low on purpose.
Well,
that's what the song is. Moaning low.
That's exactly what it is. Okay, Rob. Now you can go to the balcony.
Yeah. Now we're gonna play "Moving Slow Enough." I want to go on the back part. Does anybody remember this LP, "Fresh Air Solo"?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, we got one person.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I have that album.
This is the only machine in this collection that was on this LP. Even there was a picture in the corner here. And I found the book that was on the LP. It's Valencia. It's nice. Jerry?
Do you have an episode?
What?
Kind of wake you up.
We're going to play the Gavioli is in the upstairs in the center, and then we're going to play this Mortier Cafe organ over here, and then we'll let you mill about. So I'm not going to talk anymore after that. The Mortier over here plays cardboard books, as does the Limonaire over there. And just since I don't think you've had a chance to hear it before, the cardboard books are interesting because they take basically a square of cardboard, fold it in half, and then another piece like that, and then they glue the alternating sides together, and that's how they make the fan fold. And it's a very durable, rugged way to play an instrument, and that was typical of a lot of the band organs in the other buildings, especially European ones. So that's what the cardboard book is all about. Before I stop talking, I want to share you a quote that I think is hilarious. Again, it's from this Yazoo CD booklet. Nevin is the author. He tells a great story about collectors. He says, "Many years ago, while entertaining a group of record collectors at our home, I pointed to one of our dogs, Dixie, who has compulsive collecting habits, including absconding with shoes from every corner of the house and stashing them under the living room desk. I commented to the guys, 'Look, that shows that even lower forms of animal life have the impulse to collect.' My daughter, Lauren, about 11 at the time, cynically responded, 'No, that only shows that only lower forms of animal life have the impulse to collect.'" Thank you. You can take the elevator upstairs if that's a problem. We're going to play, again, play the Gavioli, the large one across the bank first, and then we'll play the one here. Robert?
Yes.
He has a remote and many access to the Gavioli.
Machines. I like the beat, not much of a melody.
You've got the lions on the top.
Oh, yeah. Battery.